our military, our Defense Department has came into 2022 thinking that the time at which China is likely to move on Taiwan would be sometime in 2027. They've actually said that publicly.
Wow.
The new numbers or the new expectations are in the next 1 to 2 years.
Welcome to Wealthion. I'm Wealthion founder Adam Taggart. 2022 has been a difficult year so far for investors to successfully navigate. It's had one of the worst first halves of the year for both stocks and bonds in history. And with economic growth contracting, inflation remaining at 40-year highs, and the Fed continuing to increase the cost of capital through rate hikes, financial asset prices may still have lower to go. What will be the key macro drivers through the end of this year? Are the markets through the worst of their challenges, or are things just warming up? And are there attractive opportunities for investors right now, or is this a time to hunker down? Today, we have the good fortune to put those questions to Kyle Bass, founder and CIO of Heyman Capital Management. Kyle, thanks so much for taking the time to speak with us today.
Great. Glad to be here, Adam.
Hey, well, it's such a pleasure, Kyle. Let's kick this off at a very high level, and then I have like literally a scroll's worth of questions here for you. What is your current assessment of the global economy and financial markets?
Yeah, I think that if you just look at the business CapEx numbers and you look at the jobs numbers, you know, it's clear to me that we're going to see a recession in the U.S. and a deeper recession in Europe. And when you look across to Asia, the Chinese credit impulse, consumer credit impulse, is not responding to lower rates because the Chinese household indebtedness is now a little higher than U.S. household indebtedness got prior to the global financial crisis. So it seems to me, Adam, that we're at a place in time in which we're going to have a bit of a pullback. Now, markets always anticipate pullbacks, and you and I both know we've seen about $38 trillion taken out of global equity and bond markets in 2022. So maybe the worst of it's over. I think you're going to see the Fed continue to stay aggressive, and they're going to be hiking rates into a recession, which is something that you don't normally see, but they are hell bent on trying to arrest this inflation dragon before the midterms. And so I think they're willing to cause stock market declines in the face of kind of trying to arrest inflation. So all in all, when you look at all of the indicators point down, the question is, how long will they point down? Will it be a year? Will it be a year and a half? Will it be 2 years? I think it'll only be about a year before you'll see the Fed cutting rates. So I think the structure, term structure of the bond market has actually got this called just right.
Okay. All right. Well, interesting and good to hear. That's maybe slightly more positive than some of my recent guests. So I'm actually really interested to dig into this with you. A lot of things to dig into in what you just mentioned. Let's start with your comment about the Fed trying to get inflation under control by the midterm elections. They're only, it's a little bit less than 3 months away right now. Is it realistic to think that they can really move the needle all that much on CPI between now and then?
Yeah, I think CPI is less relevant than people going to the gas pump
and how people feel, yeah,
and how they feel, and you've started to see the polling, you know, start to really get better because they have now, I think, 70 or 71 days of nothing but fuel price declines. Now, that is likely due to the fact that the administration's been selling the Strategic Petroleum Reserve right. Every day. They're selling a million barrels a day. The question is, are they selling it in the paper market or the physical market? You have the Saudi oil minister and OPEC Plus saying there's a divergence between the physical market and the paper market that they're not going to stand for. And you have the Biden administration also, again, not trying to be political, but to pull off the triple Indy, going and doing a deal with Iran to spite our long-term partners in the Middle East, the Saudis, is not going to be beneficial to this fuel price scenario. So I think they're trying to juggle too many things at the same time. But the one thing they've been able to achieve in the last 70 days is lower gas pump prices. And I think that that really factors into the psyche of Americans.
All right. And again, I guess, you know, what matters most is how people's psyches feel when they walk into the voting booth. Absolutely lower, you know, fuel costs help. That being said, I think we're still seeing, you know, high energy costs in terms of like electricity and gas for heating people's homes. Certainly food price costs are still elevated. You know, housing costs are still, you know, rent increases, all that stuff sticky. That's not going to come down anytime soon. So I guess I'm just sort of speculating here, but it seems challenging that they may get people's overall level of cost of living, their attitude toward cost of living, shifted materially enough by November. Certainly could be wrong, but I'm just curious what you think about that.
Yeah, when you look at housing in the U.S., there's some alarming statistics for the July numbers. The MLS reported that there were 5,962 new home closings in the month of July. That's the second lowest total ever in the history of reporting the MLS for the month of July. The only one that was that had a fewer number was July of 2007 at, call it, 4,700. So the average sales price on a home fell 7.4% month over month, not year over year.
Yeah, isn't that crazy?
Median sales price was down 4.5% month over month. So what you're seeing in U.S. housing and evictions were up 300% month over month. So the higher energy prices, higher fuel prices, and a housing market where you've raised rates so aggressively from zero to where we are today has caused a shock in the market. And what you're seeing right now is just kind of that air gap that I think will metastasize in the next few months. So while you might have pump prices coming down, you're affecting real economic indicators with your, with, let's just say, being too aggressive on the monetary tightening side. So look, that's why it's certain that we're in a recession. We had 3 million new jobs in the last year, and yet you didn't see any productivity growth. So we're kind of having a recovery where we're adding compliance jobs and we're adding diversity jobs, but those jobs aren't generating additional sales or additional margin. It's actually a cost to the companies.
Right.
So I think those 3 million jobs were, you know, LGBT inclusion jobs and compliance jobs and jobs that actually are counterproductive to, let's say, the economy.
Yeah, I want to dive into housing with you. I want to dive into the job market with you. Neither of those is on my big list here. Real quick for folks watching, I have a video that just got released a few hours before this one with Kyle, with housing analyst Nick Jerley, where we go into the fact that Nick's point of view, the housing correction isn't coming. It's actually in process right now, supporting some of the stats that Kyle just mentioned. I'll put up a link to that video here if you want to go watch it. All right, Kyle, hopefully if there's time, maybe I'll come back to both of those things. I do want to ask super quickly, though. I still have had a hard time really wrapping my brain around the data in the most recent payrolls report that came out, you know, a week or so ago, that was just so incredibly strong versus all the other data that we're seeing in terms of economic slowdown, the establishment employment survey, what's happening in the manufacturing sector and whatnot. How much window dressing do you think is going into that payrolls number? Maybe again, to try to make people feel that things are a little less bad before they have to go to the voting booth.
Yeah. When you look towards the inflationary recessions of the past, let's say you look back to the 70s, you look at, call it 69 to 73, and then you look at 78 to 80, payroll employment is the last indicator to turn in an inflationary recession. And so I think that number one, the data's lagged by at least 6 months, right? And I think that this expansion in payrolls, again, will be the last thing to turn. Unfortunately, Chairman Powell is focused on payroll employment, i.e., right. That's his barometer. He's focusing on the wrong barometer for this type of economic scenario. Now, he's not an economist by trade, but he's incredibly smart. And let's hope that he's listening to some of his external advisors who know this.
Right. And the 1,000+ PhDs that work at the Fed, right?
Yeah. So yeah. I think they're focused on the wrong indicator as their barometer. And maybe it's purposeful, maybe it's not, but the payrolls numbers will turn. Typically, the payrolls numbers turn 5 to 10 months into a recession. So it is way behind and it will turn.
Okay. So you are expecting that turn just on the delay. All right. So I actually want to talk about delays in terms of Fed policy, but just building on what you just said there. So the Fed right now is, if I heard you correctly, I think you said you expect them to continue hiking for the foreseeable future, at least, I think we want to assume they know they got themselves into a bit of a corner, not even a bit, a big corner. We're blowing, the everything bubble, or at least getting asset prices to probably long-term unsustainable highs and having interest rates at rock bottom lows, where when the next economic downturn came along, they had no room to drop rates because they were at zero. Now their inflation to a certain extent is giving them the excuse to raise rates. Now, of course, they have to raise rates to fight it. So it's not like it's a happy situation for them. But when you look at what the Fed is sort of looking at its main dashboard, it's saying, okay, inflation's still hot. Right? 8.5%, 40 plus year high. We got to raise rates to do that. Okay. Unemployment still near record lows. Okay. We're good there. Right. So we can continue to raise rates. And what's the market doing? Oh, well, yeah, it came down this year, but it's actually been in rally mode for the most part over the past month. So we're not breaking the market. So looking at kind of all three of those indicators, those seem to give the Fed a lot of blue sky ahead of it to continue raising rates. So is that largely sort of why you consider that they're going to keep raising from here while they can?
Yeah, I mean, the headline numbers are pushing them to raise rates. But I think that you've got a scenario where there's 40% more M2 in the system since COVID began, right?
Yeah.
And you've got a scenario where that money is still in the system. If you look at the mortgage, the way the mortgages roll off on the Fed balance sheet, the Fed is just now starting to reduce its balance sheet, literally as we speak here in August. And so that raising rates into an environment where you've put 40% more money in the system is like pushing on a string. What you've got to do is take the money out of the system, and they've just begun to do so. So if you look back to December of 2018, that was the last time they were aggressively removing money from the system and raising rates, and the market dropped 20% in a month, 22% in a month, right?
Mm-hmm.
So now that they're going to start removing 60 to 95 billion a month of risk capital from the market, I think now is where the rubber meets the road. So if you're asking, is now the time to invest? I don't think now's the time to invest. I think you need 3 to 6 months of them pulling 60 to 95 billion of risk capital out and raising rates to really try to understand where the market bottom is. And I'm not trying to pick a bottom. I'm just saying that all of the factors that are at play today are money is about to start draining and they're continuing to raise rates. Whatever Powell says at Jackson Hole, whether it's 50 or 75, I think he's backed into a corner, as you just said, Adam. So now's not the time to be aggressive, in my opinion.
All right, Kyle. Well, look, I got a lot of questions about capital allocation that we'll get to in a bit here. So just in recapping, it sounds like you think that the direction for markets is more likely to be down from here, given what you just mentioned, that we're going to start draining some of that excess, money sloshing around from the pond here while the Fed continues to hike rates. And that's going to, slow the economy even further, bring asset prices down. So a question around that, and I'm curious to hear your thoughts on this, because I've discussed this with several recent experts on this program. Historically, there's a bit of a lag when the Fed, pulls a lever and when the impact of that lever is fully felt in the economy. And historically, I've heard numbers tossed out, 9-ish months or something like that, but measured in a couple of quarters usually. So let's say you're correct, where in a couple of months of QT going on and really beginning to drain water out of the bathtub, The markets really begin to kind of nose over again, and everybody realizes we're in a recession now. We're not quibbling, quibbling. What's the word?
Quibbling.
Quibbling. Thank you. Quibbling over the definition of a recession. We just all know it doesn't feel good, right?
Right.
Now the Fed just started its rate hikes in February, and the pace of rate hikes that we've gone through is the fastest ever on record, right? And so could we be in a position where we hit this recession, market correction, and yet we still have this backlog of shockwaves from the previous rate hikes that have been done over the past, 8 months or 9 months by that time, that just keep slamming into the system month after month after month? In other words, we engineer a recession, but then it actually gets made a lot worse, not by the tightening the Fed continues to do, but by the tightening the Fed has already done.
Yeah, I actually think that the tightening, when you look back to Bernanke's helicopter speech, I probably read that speech 15 times. It's worth a reread. He talks about the zero lower bound almost as a tractor beam. He says you should avoid it at all costs in this speech. He says, but if you ever have to approach the zero lower bound on rates, you need to get away from it as quickly as possible before expectations get set at those new levels. We're at the zero lower bound for the better part of a decade, Adam. So
Right,
move,
that's investors normal now, right?
right? And so when you think mortgage rates, normal's 3.5%, normal's not six. And you get mortgages from 3.5 to 6, and you are going to have the economy turn off. And to your point, I actually think that's where they're going to take us, meaning they're going to take short rates to 3, 3.50. I actually didn't think they'd get them to 3. It's all about the delta from the bottom. It's not about the nominal number. And the delta from the bottom is almost infinite when you start at zero, right? So,
Right.
but when you move 300 basis points after you've been at zero for almost a decade, all economic activity will turn off. So you look at the auto loan data. The auto loan data is absolutely abysmal right now. The housing data is horrible, and it's just taking time to catch up. The Manheim Index of used vehicle prices, started, let's say in 2008, the average for the year was 106. For 2021, the average was 199. In 2022, it's January 2022, started the Manheim Index started at 236. It's already dropped to 211. It's dropped 10% in 8 months, and it's headed lower. It's headed lower fast. So, I think you're seeing the number of auto loans where a lot of the LTVs got to be 150%. The auto lenders are going to be in real trouble. The housing lenders are going to be in trouble. You already see mortgage lenders going broke. And you're going to see housing come to a grinding halt. Now, I don't think housing prices are going to drop like they dropped in 2008 and 9. I think you're going to see housing prices drop 10, 12% over this move. And I don't think the Fed will be able to pull more than a trillion off their balance sheet before they have to stop. So I think we have a permanent $7 trillion Fed balance sheet. But to your point, you're 6 to 8 months into pulling $100 billion a month out, and you're going to realize that you made an error.
Yeah.
But they're going to make that error.
Yeah. Look, I trust your expertise on this a lot more than mine, but I definitely agree with you here. So it sounds like you think we're going to experience, a recession, and probably not a shallow one that's probably going to hurt for a while, hurt and probably last for a while. Is that true?
The last for a while, I'm not sure, Adam. I think it's going to be so sharp. And so evident when the numbers actually start printing that they're going to have to immediately pause and immediately have to turn and start talking cutting because the severity of the recession is going to be mind-boggling in the numbers. And if you think about this, if you and I printed 40% more money 2.5 years ago, and let's just assume we moved the price level from 100 to 140. For us to generate a 135 print would be pretty easy, right? If you just tighten things up really quick. If you tighten things up too hard, too fast, you could get a print that's a 120. And the year-over-year, month-over-month, quarter-over-quarter numbers are going to scare the hell out of the Fed, right? If you follow me. So I think that's what we're going to see.
All right. So got a number of questions on this, and I still haven't gotten to the international stuff yet. So I guess my big question is what are the odds that our inflation will be resolved by the time the Fed has to make that turnaround that you're talking about? Because if it's not resolved, do we find ourselves sort of like we were in the 70s, stuck in this era where we're tightening, easing, because inflation just won't go away during the easing sessions. And so we got to tighten again to try to bring it back under control.
Yeah, I think you have to separate what the Fed can control and what they can't control. What they can control is, I think they can control the credit impulse from both businesses and consumers. What they can't control are supply side problems driven sure. by bad policy. And we all know we're talking about energy, whether it's natural gas or oil or both. We have been following small NGOs and 16-year-olds to set our green energy policy. And we all want a transition to renewables to work. But when you actually take the science and the math to it, we don't have a transition policy. And what the administration in the US and unfortunately what those in Europe are now learning the lesson of is not having a policy is a dire consequence of poor planning. And I think that, you know, in Germany, you're seeing natural gas prices almost $200 an M. You're seeing 2023 power prices at $700 a megawatt hour.
Isn't that crazy? I mean,
that's 14 times the five-year running average, just to put things in perspective. So you're seeing things that are so ill-advised, and you're seeing Gerhard Schroeder and the people in Germany that have basically sold Europe to the Russians. And in the U.S., our green energy policy and our Green New Deal, I know everyone feels good about it. Hell, I run a private equity conservation oriented business. I want that as much as anyone. But you have to be pragmatic and set these policies. The Fed can't change the price of crude oil or nat gas. They can't do it. Right. The only thing that's helping them right now is they're causing such a recession that they might be able to affect demand. A little bit. But what's really in need of fixing is the supply side. And the price is going to be the arbiter of fixing the supply side. There's still institutional capital coming out of the hydrocarbon business. Mm-hmm. It's not going in. Family offices and a few institutions are in, but on a net basis, there's still money running out because they've been fat shamed into not investing in hydrocarbons. Mm-hmm. Right?
That's a great way to put it. It's a great analogy. So I've had natural resources investor Rick Rule in this program several times where he's talked about even kind of forgetting the extraordinary things that are happening this year, that we have underinvested so much in CapEx in a lot of the traditional energy space that there are going to be shortages just due from that alone going forward. And of course, with the mismanaged transition, and I'm saying transition in air quotes here, that's just compounding the factor here. So getting back to my question then, so that's obviously inflationary, right? Which is, you know, persistently higher energy prices that the Fed has no control over. So what type of era do you see us heading into here?
Yeah, I think the energy conundrum is the hard part of this. This would be a quick, sharp recession if we had the supply side of energy figured out. Unfortunately, right. we don't. And so I think we can come back from a sharp decline to, let's just say, a slow growth baseline. But the slow growth baseline in the US will most likely be a multi-year recession in Europe. You know, you can't just imagine if your energy bill was $400 a month and now it's $5,000 a month.
Right.
Right. It actually doesn't work. When you think about median incomes and you think about the average person across Europe, the average person across the US, those numbers don't work. And so I don't know what Europe's going to do. If you've already seen subsidization programs pop up in places like France, in places like the Iberian Peninsula, where they're regulating caps to the input prices of nat gas into power plants, all that means is the governments are going to subsidize the losses. And again, doesn't solve the supply side problem. It probably makes it worse. So if we all decided that small modular nuclear was the answer, the green answer to this crisis, which in my opinion it is, we still have a 10-year duration mismatch, Adam. We got a real problem. The first small modular nuclear plant to open in the U.S. will open in Jackson Hole or near there 7.5 years from now. It's fully funded, it's being built, it's permitted, all of those things. So that duration mismatch worries me.
All right, so it seems like slow growth worldwide is sort of the predictable outcome of all this. And not for nothing, the IMF just released their revised global growth projections. They were at, if I can remember this correctly, I think 6.3 for 2021, 3.2 for 2022, so almost a 50% decline. And then they're down in the twos for 2023. I don't know what they have for beyond there, but looking through your lens, Kyle, it probably goes even lower in the outer years there.
Yeah, I mean, as you know, the IMF never gets it right on the
I know.
downside.
I hate to source them, but even they are predicting lower and slower.
You know, China, if you just look at China's numbers, China housing volume sales are already down 30% this year, and price is down 7%. And real estate in its concentric circles represent 40% of Chinese GDP. And so the drag on Chinese GDP from real estate alone is 3 points. And then you look at industrial production, and that drag, I think, could be at least 2 points. I mean, if China actually prints the real number, they could be at zero. So this global growth scenario of 2022 at 3% is a pipe dream. That'll be revised way down. But the question is, who, if Europe is struggling with the enormity of their power crisis, and we haven't even had the winter yet, Adam.
I know.
The winter could cause discontinuous pricing. And so China's not going to be the growth engine to the world. The US is actually the best of all the markets. And I would suggest staying with investments in US markets, but I also would wait a few months to kind of see the whites of their eyes here and see how the market reacts to the Fed's balance sheet contracting along with an aggressive rate hikes.
All right, and thanks. We're beginning to build the capital case here. So we've already, heard from you. Wait a little bit. Market's likely to head down sooner. We've also just heard U.S. probably best market to put capital in for the time being. I'm glad you went to China. I had a number of questions about China. Maybe we can just do rapid fire through them, so that I at least scratch some of this itch for users. You've already answered the most important question, which is sort of what do you see as its outlook economically? Sounds like you see substantially slower growth there. Real estate market there is obviously the big enchilada. It's the world's biggest asset, apparently. Feel free to answer anything else about their economy you haven't yet, if there's anything you want to say. But from a political stability side, how secure is Chairman Xi there? Is he going to be around for a long time, or are things more politically unstable than the people in the West imagine?
Well, I mean, the way the headlines read and the way that he has consolidated his power, it seems like he's going to be emperor for life. Kind of grabbing the term from Mao. But I think that inflation is a disaster for a communist regime. Popular uprising is also a disaster. And what's happening, if you look at the birth rate in China, it's dropped to 1.2. So when you understand what's happened here, China has allowed real estate prices to grow unabated from 2009 to about a year ago. And you saw median home price got to be 36 times median income. At the peak of US folly in 2006 and 2007, We got to about 6.5 times.
Right.
Right.
So six times worse than our worst ever metric.
Yeah. And that was in tier one cities. In tier two and tier three, it was a little less, but still like orders of magnitude different, not just multiples different. And so what happened is Chinese men are graduating university and they're going back to live in their parents' basement, and they're not dating, they're not marrying, and they're not procreating. So China abandoned its one child policy, realizing that its demographic profile was actually not healthy for their economy.
But right, basically ate out the bottom of that pyramid, right?
That's right. And instead of that decline, that was a steady decline going from now until 2050, the new line is an absolute falling off a cliff line. Mm. Just last night, South Korea smashed their own record for lack of fertility or lack of births. So you're seeing this real estate phenomenon again. With central planning and central banking, you can't spin all of the plates and keep them spinning properly, or else,
yeah.
Or else we'd all be speaking Russian today, right? So I think from this scenario, what Xi has learned is that he is going to stomp out residential and real estate speculation. And so the 9 or 10 Chinese developers that are in some stage of default today, they're going to stay in default. And if you're a Western bondholder, what you're going to get in return, it rhymes with hero. You're not going to get paid anything. And that's what you're going to deserve for investing in a regime like that as a Westerner. But that Chinese real estate market needs to come way down, and it needs to stay down for their economy to, quote, work. And so I just believe that you're not going to see a rapid turnaround. And what's interesting is the total social financing, which is their kind of credit impulse number, is a number where you have government and then you have consumer, and they've been cutting rates and there's been no consumer response.
Yeah.
And it's really troubling the central planners from my contacts say over there. So I don't see the credit impulse returning even as they cut rates. So China's in real trouble.
All right. And you're much more of a China expert than I, so correct me if this is a wrong assumption, but I've heard that, you know, the average Chinese citizen, they put their savings into real estate much more so than Americans do. And of course, we've all heard about the ghost cities and whatnot there. So if you're saying that the official policy is to bring the speculation out of the real estate market, seems like there's a lot of speculation to remove from there. As I mentioned, it's the world's biggest asset. So just on an absolute value, that's a lot of value that they're vaporizing here.
That's
apparently going to really smack down consumer spending there, right?
Yeah. I mean, it will decimate consumer spending. And what the central party has said is the local governments need to increase their government land sales to make up the deficits in their budgets. Well, if developers are broke, they're not going to be increasing their government land sales
right.
To developers. If you get a zero household debt growth number, which is what it looks like right now, you're going to see housing volume drop over 50% year over year. And you're going to see price drop 15%, and their banking sector is 3.5 times more levered than the U.S. banking sector was going into the global financial crisis. So again,
what's the contagion risk?
It's worse all the way through.
Yeah, what's the contagion risk here that China could have its own 2008 moment?
You know, I tend to think that they can abandon moral hazard at some point in time. The domestic Chinese market is an RMB-based market, and they can print as many RMB as they want to print, and they can plug holes, and they can fix things, and they can abandon moral hazard. They haven't done so yet, call it en masse, but I think if things get bad enough, they will. And their dollar-based interactions with the world are their external interactions. And the question is, do they really have the reserves they say they have, $3 trillion? I don't think they do. So the question is, if their internal marketplace is doing so poorly, How are they going to be able to function externally? And especially with their new militaristic belligerence vis-a-vis Taiwan, you know, they're really walking the razor's edge here. If they decide to move on Taiwan, their economy is going to, I think, fall directly into the toilet.
All right. Well, let's go there because that was one of the next questions here. Is everything going on around Taiwan? Is that serious or is that just saber rattling, do you think?
I don't know. I think it's really serious. And so does the U.S. military and DOD. I think our military, our Defense Department came into 2022 thinking that the time at which China is likely to move on Taiwan would be sometime in 2027. They've actually said that publicly.
Wow.
The new numbers or the new expectations are in the next 1 to 2 years.
Really?
And so DOD is spinning up a number of programs to deal with this potential risk. If you saw the Chinese embassy, Xinjiang just gave a press conference on August 16th. What was that? 8 days ago, where he accused the U.S. of running more than 100 crossings of the Taiwan Strait with U.S. warships. We've only run 7 this year, according to the U.S. Navy. And so even their rhetoric that's public is full of lies, and their response to Pelosi's visit is disproportionate. And the ratchet is moving faster than anyone expected it to move, but they're just using Pelosi's visit as an excuse to go ahead and make this new move and change their defensive position to being offensive in the Taiwan Straits. And I think it's inevitable that they move on Taiwan. And that changes the whole ballgame for people that have money invested in Chinese companies. They need to get it out right now.
Wow. Okay. Got so many questions. First off, I guess, do you think Russia's invasion of Ukraine has emboldened China in its terms of its Taiwan strategy?
Yeah, I look back to the February 4th press release, February 4th, 2022, where Xi Jinping and Vladimir Putin issued a joint press release. You should go reread that press release. Read it carefully. They talk about supporting each other's moves, where they say their new partnership, quote, has no limits and no boundaries to the strategic partnership, i.e. Wow. Nuclear proliferation, yep. Spy satellites, whatever you want to talk about, the Russians and the Chinese are in it together, and they say it in this press release. And Xi supports Putin's reacquisition of Ukraine in this press release. Mind you, this is 20 days before the invasion. And Putin supports the reacquisition of, quote, the Taiwanese separatists. I mean, they literally tell you what they're going to do. And they tell you that they are going to strategically partner in any way possible to make this happen. So when you say, has China learned anything from Russia's invasion? My answer to that is China and Russia have had these battle plans drawn up together for a long time. In the last 10 years, Xi Jinping has met face to face with Putin 40 times. Just think about that for a second.
Wow. And I'm just curious, what's that relative to meeting with the U.S. president over that same period?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I'm going to go look that up. But I'd be willing to bet that number is 10 or less, right? They don't meet more than once a year.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. Russia right now is still in Ukraine. It still has control over all the resources that it went in there to get. And so that may embolden China to say, hey, look, they seem to be getting away with it with their plan. So maybe we will too. Of course, Taiwan is different in terms of where the U.S. is concerned. We have, I think, much more direct national interests in Taiwan. So what do you think the implications would be? I mean, is this something that conceivably China and the U.S. could get into a hot war over?
I do. I think it's likely, but I also think that we are not going to send carrier strike groups to go get in a hot war in the Chinese, the Taiwanese Strait. You know, if they have one of their carrier killer missiles sink one of our carriers, we lose 5,000 men and women. And I think those are unacceptable losses to the public. I bet that polls less than 30% amongst the American public's desire to go support Taiwan. But one thing that we can do, we hold the economic nuclear button against China. China's interactions with the rest of the world on a daily basis basically revolve around the dollar, that 85% of their cross-border settlements are handled in dollars. Mm-hmm. And so they desperately need oil, they desperately need gas, they desperately need food, basic materials. They are desperately short many things that they need to acquire in international markets every single day. If we sanction their SOE banks, their joint stock banks, and pull them off the SWIFT system, I think the Chinese economy collapses in a matter of weeks. So if I were the president of the United States, or if I were running Treasury, I'd be socializing the concept that if they move on Taiwan, we will remove them from the SWIFT system. And that kind of deterrence is what worked in the Cold War with Russia, right? With nukes versus nukes. We're not socializing that concept, but I can tell you behind the scenes, we are talking about it right now.
All right. So, I mean, China's got to be aware of that vulnerability. So if it seems increasingly likely that they may actually go into Taiwan, how are they planning on defending against that?
Yeah, well, if you remember, when we started, we had a presidential commission about to roll out on the studying the origins of COVID virus and what basically how it started and how all the global actors acted. And when we announced that presidential commission, the very first thing that the Chinese foreign ministry did is within an hour, they held a press conference. And they said, if this commission is convened, we will withhold antibiotics from the United States. And we killed that commission immediately. So 95% of the active pharmaceutical ingredients in all US antibiotics are made in Wuhan. Wow. We rely solely on China to produce our 100% of our blood pressure medicine, 95% of antibiotics. They also control the production of ibuprofen in both Advil and Tylenol. Like, we allowed that frog to boil over time, and they will use that against us. And so this is while we hold the nuclear button on their economy, they have us by the short hairs in a number of situations.
All right. So interesting. When we started this conversation, I was thinking, oh, Kyle's actually got a little bit of a rosier view than most of the folks I talked to about what's going to happen over the next year, you know, with the economy. But you've got a much, I think, darker view of what could happen in the big picture here. So it sounds like you're saying, and I don't want to put words in your mouth and saying that you're calling for a hot war between the US and China within 2 years. But it sounds like you feel like that's a big enough concern that we should be thinking about, you know, what we as investors and just regular humans of the world should do in case that happens.
Yeah. I mean, Adam, if you look at the laws that China's put into place in the last 12 months, they have made it legal for the Chinese government to nationalize U.S. investment in China in what they call, in the event of, quote, special circumstances, which include war. Imagine how much capital institutionally through endowments, pensions, foundations, and even individually through BlackRock and others like that. Think about how much money is invested in China.
Right.
The day Putin invaded Ukraine, anyone that had investments in Russia lost everything. And endowments had to write them down to zero. Hundreds of millions of dollars were written down to zero that day. The difference is in China, it's going to be tens of billions of dollars. They were able to sweep the Russian losses under the rug. And you're not going to be able to sweep the Chinese losses under the rug. So investing in a regime that is so diametrically opposed to the value system that we all live by is going to end up biting investors hard. And I think that the Chinese invasion of Taiwan is probable. I think it's greater than 50% in the next 48 months, or I'd say the next 24 months. And so why would you ever own a Chinese investment? If you look at the Shanghai Composite or the Shenzhen Composite over a 10-year period, you're basically flat. And the S&P over a 10-year period, you've made like 12% annualized returns. We actually have a rule of law and respect human rights here. So it makes no sense. You're not getting paid any kind of premium to own a Chinese asset. You should just, I believe investors should sell everything they have in China right now.
Okay. All right. Well, look, I got a ton of questions that I'm not going to get to. And yes, folks, you can criticize me for not being able to squeeze those in, but it's really Kyle's fault because he's such a font of wisdom on so many great topics. But let's go right there now, Kyle, into, okay, so the folks that are that watch this channel, follow you, you know, wherever you are in the media, are really just, in most cases, trying to be good stewards of the capital that they have built up so far in their lives. And they'd like to grow it going forward, but more importantly, they don't want to lose it or become collateral damage in a lot of the things that we're talking about here. So as you look out for the next year or two at all these, you know, potential trends that we've been talking about, where do you think the average individual's capital, you know, will be better served? Either it sounds like markets, you prefer the U.S. market more than most others. Are there particular asset classes you like? You know, is cash a pretty good play right now? What would your general advice be?
Yeah, I would say in the near term, you need to...
Our interview with Kyle will continue over in part two, which will be released on this channel tomorrow as soon as we're finished editing it. To be notified when it comes out, subscribe to this channel if you haven't already by clicking on the subscribe button below, as well as that little bell icon right next to it. And be sure to hit the like button too while you're down there. And remember, we're continuing our new practice of publishing my top takeaways from these weekly interviews. To get mine from this interview with Kyle, for free, just go to wealthion.com/Adam's Notes. And finally, if the challenging macro outlook Kyle's detailed in this interview has you feeling a little vulnerable about the prospects for your wealth, then consider scheduling a free, no-strings-attached portfolio review by a financial advisor who can help manage your wealth, keeping in mind the trends and risks that Kyle has mentioned here. Just go to wealthion.com and we'll help set one up for you. Okay, I'll see you next in part two of our interview with Kyle Bass.